enough.
Yeah. Hey, Arlene, it will. Is this alright? Is this on?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It can be edited out. It's not so.
Right. Here we go.
Okay. Yeah, no, this is someone else's, and I... Okay. Okay. I wrote my dissertation after interviewing Orthodox single women on sexual religious conflict, and a colleague of mine interviewed men on the same topic, and what I wrote about there was looking at the Talmud and Hasidic sources and trying to find a sexual ethic that could speak to unmarried people today. The topic, and a couple of years ago, I also co-authored a sex manual for newlywed couples. The point of this course is really to deal with the halachic issues. And the halachic issues of Shomer Negiah, which we talked about last night, premarital sex, which we'll do next week, and masturbation, which we'll do the following week. That's the main... Do you also need... Bring a chair. Or you could take this chair.
Oh,
maybe you'd have to stand. Okay. That's the main point of the course. The point of this first session, the challenge of sexuality or the struggle of Talmudic sexuality, is really to try to set a more human face to it. For those of you who were here last night, we saw the halachic sources, and many of them are extremely rigid in terms of the demands. I think that in this first class, seeing the narrative, seeing the story, the way that it gets integrated into life, or the way that it doesn't get, the halakha either does or doesn't get integrated into life, is important in terms of framing the halakha. Okay? A lot of people kind of going around in the room mentioned, obviously, this is something in all of our lives. And I think that in the end, it's not only about the halakhic sources, it's also about how do we take those sources, or which sources do we take, and integrate them into our life in one way or another, or choose not to. And so I think that seeing the Talmudic sources, seeing the struggle and framing it in that way is kind of helpful as a precursor to seeing the halachic sources. Okay? So the point at which I want to start is a source in Kiddushin, Daf Chavtet Amud Bet 29b, a discussion of what is the ideal age of marriage. Okay? We're not going to get to all of these sources because we're ending at 3 o'clock. So it could be that some of them I'll read just in English. Some of them we might not get to at all. Rav Chista praised Rav Hamnuna before Rav Huna as a great man. Said he to him, "When he visits you, bring him to me." When he arrived, he saw that he wore no head covering. And he asks him, "Why don't you have a head covering?" "Because I am not married," was the reply. Thereupon Rav Huna turned his face away from him and said, "See to it that you do not appear before me again before you are married." Okay? So we see, basically, Rav Huna turns away, doesn't want to even look at Rav Hamnuna, certainly doesn't want to believe that he's a great man because of the fact that he's not married. And the Gemara then explains that Rav Huna went in accordance with his own views, for he said, "He who is 20 years of age and not married spends all his days in sin." Okay, so the Gemara asks, in sin? Can you really think so? But say, spends all his days in sinful thoughts. Okay, so here we see the concept that Rav Huna at least believes that once one reaches the age of 20 and isn't married, sexual thoughts will overcome them, and that's just a given in terms of human nature. Okay, the Gemara then goes on. Rava says, and also the school of Rabbi Yishmael says, "Ad kaf shana, ad esrim shana yosheva kadosh baruch hu umitzapel adam matay yisa isha, kevan shehigia esrim shana velo nasa, omer tipachatz motav." Okay, that until a person reaches the ripe old age of 20, God sits and waits and says, when will he get married? And if he reaches the age of 20 and doesn't get married, God says, blasted be his bones. Okay, in other words, that's all of these, and we'll see in the rest of this passage, moving towards a position of early marriage, and in fact, very early marriage. Okay, the Gemara goes on and tells the story of Rav Chista. Rav Chisda says, Hi, da'adifna mechavrai, da'nestivna b'sheitzar. I'm better than my friends because I got married at 16. V'i hava nestivna barbesar, hava mina l'satan gira beinecha. But had I gotten married even younger than that, at the age of 14, then I would really have shot an arrow in Satan's eye. Hey, what's the meaning of that? That had he gotten married at 14, puberty would have hit at the exact moment that he was getting married, and he would not have had a period of sexual temptation at all. Because at the moment when the temptation would begin, he would already be getting married. Okay? The passage then just ends with a discussion of what is the age range for which God will wait for you to get married. Is it from 16 to 22, or is it from 18 to 24? But we see, okay, even though that might be the bottom line, that early marriage is something that's considered a good thing. Elsewhere, the Gemara actually even talks about getting married even earlier than 14, samuch lepirkan, which is 13. Some even understand it as close to the age of 13, starting from 12 and a half, okay? So for those of you who are looking at me strangely when I said, you know, puberty at age 14, we can move the earliest age of marriage back even as young as 12 and a half. And so what we see, I think, in this Gemara very clearly is that if marriage is coextensive with puberty, there is no time for sexual sin to begin. And here, early marriage seems to be the solution to the problem of sexual desire. Okay? Now, again, this Gemara, what meaning does it have for us today? Right? I don't know. In other words, I'm not obviously not bringing it to suggest that it has any normative weight and that we should be getting married at these ages. But what I think it does do for us is it frames the discussion. And it says that the Talmud was very aware of sexual desire as a human thing and as something that it felt couldn't be bracketed or couldn't be pushed aside. Okay? And that in itself, I think, is an important awareness to start out with. Okay? Okay. The next passage, one brief line, Ein apotropos la'arayot, there is no guardian against sexual immorality, is a phrase that's used in the Gemara several times. It's used in halachic sources as well. The story that's told here is a case of maids of Cleopatra where a guardian was protecting them from having sex except on one specific night. Okay? In order to be able to tell how many days it takes for a male fetus to be fully developed and for a female fetus to be fully developed. So once it was kind of like a scientific experiment. Once the queen knew that they were only having sex on this night, and then she saw who was pregnant with a female and a male, she could test and see at what point does the fetus become fully formed. The point of the story is that there seems to be a disparity how long it takes a male fetus, a female fetus to be formed. But the Gemara then says, you know, maybe the guardian himself had sex with a woman on a different day, okay? Because ein apotropos la'arayot. There is no guardian with regard to issues of sexual immorality. There's no one who can kind of watch over it. There's no one who's like distant, objective, completely safe. Even the guardian himself can be seduced. Okay? So I think that that's an important concept, and it comes as the opinion of the sages, as the majority opinion, and it gets used halachically in different contexts as well. Okay. The next source, and please stop me. If anyone has a question, feel free to stop me. Sorry that I'm kind of running. The next source is Chagiga, 16a. It's a statement of Rabbi Eli HaZaken. A famous statement, could be that some people in the room have heard it before. The Ha'amar Rabbi Eli HaZaken, Im ro'eh adam sheitzro mitgaber alav, if a person sees themselves being overcome with desire, sexual desire, yelech lemakom she'ein makirin oto, v'yelbash shchorin, v'yitatev shchorin, v'yaseh ma shelibo chafetz, v'al yechalel shem shamayim b'farhesya. He should go to a place where no one knows him, dress in black, wrap himself in black, and there let out his desires.
And the first time I ever taught this passage, I made the mistake of wearing black unintentionally. Everyone's looking at me strangely. But this passage is really interesting because normally, right, we think that we have the mitzvot, we have the commandments, and we should be able to observe them, right? In other words, we should be able to struggle and to overcome desire. It's very interesting, and this might be, you know, the one passage that has this idea, where Rabbi Eli HaZaken says, sometimes, and the way that the Gemara establishes this case, is as a case where the person is unable to overcome their desire. So that in itself is an interesting point. The fact that Rabbi Eli is recognizing that despite the halakha, despite the laws that exist, there may be times when a person is unable to overcome their desire. And here, let me tell you the right way to violate halakha. Okay? And that right way involves going to a different place, dressing in black. The details are not what's important for me now. What's important for me now is the recognition on the part of Rabbi Eli HaZaken, a Tana, that sometimes people will be overcome and sometimes sexual desire can be an unstoppable force. Okay? It's a concept that also comes up in the Gemara in Ketubot, in two passages that I didn't bring here. I'll just mention them outside briefly. One is Ketubot, page 51, where it talks about a case, it's actually a disturbing case, where of a rape, which begins as rape and ends as consent. In other words, it starts out as a rape, and at the end, the woman is saying, please continue. Okay? It's a case that's obviously hard for us to imagine. But one opinion in the understanding of that case is that the woman is still okay to return to her husband, because what Rava says is Yetzer Albasha, that at the moment that the rapist started having sex with the woman, she was overcome with desire and then needed the rape to be completed. Okay, which is, the example itself is horrific. But the point behind it, if we can detach from the example itself, two points. One is, the cases that we've seen thus far are phrased in terms of the male and male sexuality. And so if we had time, I'm sure if we had more time, I'm sure someone would have asked, okay, is it just the male that's kind of seen as having sexuality be an overwhelming force? What about women? What about female sexuality? So this is a passage that deals specifically with women. And the second thing is that we see also sexual desire being considered a powerful force and a force that's, I would say, kind of stronger than the situation. The situation is extremely disturbing, but I'll bring another example that's not as disturbing in terms of the case, which makes the same point, which is just a few pages later in Ketubot, page 54, it talks about a case of a widow whose husband has died, and who's still living off of the husband's property. Okay, a widow is allowed to remain in her husband's house, living off the property for as long as she wants until she remarries. Okay, so the Gemara there asks about a question about a widow who doesn't remarry but has sex outside of marriage. What do we say about this widow? Can she still live on the property because she hasn't remarried? Or are we going to kick her out because we're saying, clearly you're not in mourning for your husband anymore because you're going around and having sex with other people? And the opinion of Rav Yosef there is, we allow her to continue living at the property because we say, Yetzer Ansa. She was overwhelmed with sexual desire. And the fact that she went and had sex with someone, even during her period of mourning for her husband, doesn't signify that she's ready to get married or that she's moved on beyond, you know, the memory of her husband. All that it signifies is sexual need, which is seen as independent of kind of those larger questions. Okay, so these are a few examples you know, some of them obviously quite disturbing, that make the point of how seriously the Talmud took the subject of sexual desire, how overwhelming a force it was seen to be, both for men and for women as well. Good? Okay. Okay. So, what I... Yeah.
Couldn't you make the argument, though, that, like... I mean, you're kind of framing it like the first case in Ketubot 51 would be, like, okay, we're looking now more about women and not just focusing on men's sexuality. But couldn't you say that it's really the view of a men's sexuality of women? It's not really coming from a female perspective.
100%. 100% you could say that. The issue is that this is the closest we can get. In other words, if we're trying to look at the Talmudic conception of female sexuality, we're never going to actually have it in the pure voice of a woman, because the Talmud is a text that's written by men. The most that we'll have is either a story about a woman, and there are stories about women and female sexuality, interesting stories, disturbing stories, but it's always going to be filtered through the lens of the redactors of the Talmud, who were men. So, you're right. Yeah.
I guess this is a general request. I would also be interested to hear a little bit about your own take on some of these sources, because my first approach, and also this has always been my experience, is like deep anger towards
right.
these things.
Like, okay.
There's, I mean, all I hear so far mm-hmm. is shame, and like we live in a reality, I live in a reality mm-hmm. of B'nai Brown, and knowing what the difficulty that shame has on a human being and what that does there. Mm-hmm. The fact that like intimacy and rape are the way I'm supposed to like learn
right.
some things
right.
from text, and I'm like, I won't, like, I feel my resistance, so I would mm-hmm. be really interested
right.
to hear some of your
right.
own.
Right. So what I want to say is this, and this is something, kind of a struggle that I've dealt with since starting the quest to try to find a livable sexual ethic in Talmudic sources, which is, and it's a critique that others have said to me, they'll say, because soon we'll start looking at stories, and they'll say, look, all of your stories are of prostitutes and of this type of like back alley, shameful sexuality, and how are we supposed to get to a positive sexual ethic from there? And how I would respond to that is just to say, this is what we have. And at a certain point, I think it's about making a choice of, am I committed to mining the sources that we have, let's say in the Talmud, and finding a sexual ethic from there? Or do I want to say it was a different culture, it was a different whatever, and I'm going to look elsewhere for the guidelines, or for a positive sexual ethic? For me, personally, having grown up in a world, and since, let's say, the age of 11, when I first encountered the Talmud, that having been the formative text in my life. So for me, it's very important to say, I want to go back to this text, and I want to find a sexual ethic that comes out of this text, even if I'm drawing the messages out of stories that are disturbing and that it doesn't fully add up. Do you know what I mean? For me, it's important. And for me, I'm also able to make that separation and say, okay, yes, all right, it was a rape case. I'm not going to focus on the horrific nature of the case. I'm going to focus on what I can get from that, which for our purposes is that the Talmud considers sexual desire to be a real issue. In other words, for those people who ask today, how is it possible to live with the laws that are so restrictive and that prohibit any form of sexual expression before marriage. So to go back and say, well, look, the Talmud saw sexual desire as a real force, as an unstoppable force that proposed early marriage. So clearly, I don't think that the Talmud would necessarily even expect that there would be full compliance with those laws. Even if we're learning the laws as they are in the books, we also have to think about the gap between the law and is it livable. But the way that I'm getting to those things from the Talmud, you're right,
is going to be from stories where there will be something disturbing about it, and it's a question of what part of the text am I looking at and what part of the text am I putting aside. But it's important for me.
Based and on your
own personal, obviously, values. Right. And again, it's a negotiation that everyone will have and that everyone will have differently. And I'm sure that, you know, the people in this room with various levels of investment, commitment to the various texts. And so for one person, it might be very easy to say, you know what? What do I need this? I'm going to turn to Rabbi Elliot Dorf's letter that he wrote for the board of the conservative movement. I forget what it's called, but it's called This Is My Beloved, This Is My Friend, a rabbinic letter on intimate relations, okay? Which is, he's a rabbi in the modern day, conservative rabbi, writing this rabbinic letter. And someone might say, you know, why do I need these sources? I'll go and read that, and that will give me more. Okay? For someone like me, I feel like reading that letter, okay, that's nice, and you're bringing in modern values and whatever, but I want to see it coming from the sources. Okay? So in other words, the question is, how important is it to you to find the values from the sources, and how important is it to say, you know what? In this realm, it doesn't matter what the sources say. I want to embrace, you know, the modern values, since they're going to lead me more easily to a sex positive ethic. Okay? All the sources that I'm going to look at, and really all of my work in this field, is in some level layered with conflict, because that's just how it is. Once we have the halakha prohibiting things, once we have human desire, right, the way that you spoke about it, once we like both halakha and sexuality, there's going to be a conflict. And once there's the conflict, it's not going to just be positive and smiley and seamless. There's going to be a negotiation, and it's going to be messy. So that's the short answer. Okay. Sure. Moving along. The next source, Chata Yisrael, Israel has sinned. This is Sanhedrin Mem Dalet, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Zavda, Afal Pisha Chata Yisrael Hu. So even though he has sinned, he's still a Jew. Okay? This is said about someone, Achan, in the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, commits a crime. He steals from the booty that was left over from Yericho. But yet, he's called Yisrael, even at the moment when he sins. Okay? Now, this statement, Afal pi shechata Yisrael hu, even though he has sinned, he's still called a Jew, brings us to the concept in Chassidut of what's known as the Pintel Yid. Okay? Which is an inner point that's seen to be had by every Jew, an inner spark of holiness where your actions can't impact it. So the reason that I like this passage and bring this passage in this context is specifically to speak to those issues of shame and guilt, which some people might feel upon violating the halakha, specifically in the sexual realm. From what I've seen in terms of interviews and personal conversations, is that the issue, the feelings of shame and guilt emerge again and again. And I don't know if that's something that's unique to people from the halachic community. I think it's something that a lot of people experience around issues of sexuality. But I think that this statement of Afal pi shechata Yisrael hu, of knowing that one has that basic spark of holiness, no matter what one does, no matter what halacha one violates, is an important kind of basis to have, like a core belief to take with one as one walks through life in whatever way. Okay, let's move to a story, okay? Because there are a few stories that I'd like to get to. We'll see how many we get to look at. So the first is a story about Abaye, okay? Abaye was one of the great Talmudic sages, okay? Probably one of the first people you'll learn about when learning the Talmud, because he appears so often. And Abaye tells a story, okay? He heard a man saying to a woman, let's go and travel together. Okay? Abaye said, I'm going to be a good guy. I'm going to follow them, and I'm going to make sure that they don't sin. Because to Abaye, it was totally clear that if you have a man and woman traveling together, something is going to happen. So he follows them, and it says he follows them for a few miles as they're across the meadows, okay? But, you know, nothing is happening. And then they separate, and he hears them saying to each other, Urchin Rechika Vitzavtin Besima, which is, our path is long, our company was pleasant, it was nice to walk together. Goodbye. And they part ways, okay? And Abaye then says, if it was me, I would not have been able to restrain myself. If it was him, he would have definitely fallen into some type of sexual sin. And he goes, and it says here, which is, I guess, an interesting sign of anguish, Tala nafshe bi'ibura didasha umitsta'er. He leaned in deep anguish against a doorpost. And then a certain old man came up to him, and the Rishonim say that the old, when you have that phrase of Ahu Saba, a certain old man, refers to Eliyahu Hanavi, okay, came up and taught him, Kol hagadol mechaviro yitzro gadol himenu. The greater the person, the greater their evil inclination. Okay, or the greater this force of Yetzer. Okay, now, Reb Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, a Hasidic thinker from the 19th century, writes about this story, and he writes about the context, he writes about seeing desire as a sign of greatness. Because what he writes is that Yetzer, the quality of desire, is like a two-sided coin, right? It could be expressed either for the good or for the bad. And so corresponding to one's potential for good, the more potential one has for good, similarly, the more potential one has for bad. And that's basically the lesson that Eliyahu HaNavi tries to say to Abaye, the fact that you wouldn't have been able to stop yourself from the sexual sin is because you have more potential than this other person. But the reason that I bring this story is to say Abaye is one of the most famous Amoraim. And we see here, we don't see him really struggling with sexual desire. We see him acknowledging that he would not have been able to do what these other two people did. Or is that he would have fallen into a sexual sin simply if he were walking alone with the woman, you know, for several miles across the meadow. Okay? And in the teaching of Eliyahu HaNavi that he gives him, Kol HaGadol Mechaviro Yitzro Gadol Himenu, it gives us that, it makes that point that a person shouldn't see desire as a bad thing. Okay? They should see it as a sign of their potential greatness because of that two-sided coin. Okay? So that's a story with Abaye.
Who is the person that wrote?
Reb Tzadok HaKohen Milublin is a Polish Hasidic thinker, lived in the 19th century. His most famous book is called Tzidkat HaTzadik, The Righteousness of the Righteous. And I love him. I think he's fabulous. He wrote the Sefer Tzidkat HaTzadik when he was 25 years old, which is part of what I like about it. And it was written 1848. So it's a little more than 150 years ago. And his attunement to modern psychology is just amazing. Hopefully we'll come back to him in 2 weeks when we talk about masturbation, because he writes a lot about that. So we'll talk about him in more detail there. But that's Reb Tzadok. Okay. So I want to look at one more story. A story of someone named Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya. Okay? Has anyone heard of him? You guys seen this story before? Okay. So the Gemara starts off, this is Gemara Avodah Zarah Yud Zayin Mud Aleph. Amru alav al Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, shelo hiniach zona achat ba'olam shelo ba'aleha. Hey, they said about Rabbi Elazar ben Zerodiah that there was not a single prostitute in the world that he had not had sex with. Okay, so an extreme case. Pam achat shama sheyesh zona achat bekarchei hayam vaitano telet kistinarim bischara. Okay, so he heard about a prostitute that he had not yet visited in an island in the sea, who took a whole bag of coins as her price. Natal kistinarin v'alach v'avar aleha shiva ne'arot. Okay, so he took that bag of coins and he crossed the seven rivers to get to her. Bishat hergel davar heficha. Okay, I see the English translation. Sometimes I just paste the English translation from the Sansino. At the moment when they were having sex, she passed gas. Okay, it wasn't just that she blew out wind, as the translation says here, okay? And she said to Rabbi Elazar ben Zerodiah, Kishim shahaficha zu eina chozeret limkoma, kach Elazar ben Zerodiah in mekablino tobi tshuva. Okay? Just like this gas that came out of me can't go back inside, so too you, Rabbi Elazar ben Zerodiah, will never be accepted if you try to repent. Okay? So, what an anticlimactic way to end this journey where he had crossed the seven rivers and brought the bag of coins. But it kind of serves as a wake-up call to him. What am I doing with my life? So he goes and he sits between harim u'gva'ot, hills and valleys. Okay? And he says to them, he asks them, harim u'gva'ot bikshu alai rachamim. He says to them, and he's going to go to the various facets of nature and say, go and ask God to have mercy on me. Okay, but the mountains and the valleys say, we're busy with our own problems. Okay, we don't want to help you. Okay, so then he goes to the Shamayim Va'aretz, the heavens and the earth, and he says, okay, you guys, go to God and intercede on my behalf. They say, also, we have our own problems. He goes to the sun and the moon. He goes to the stars. No one is willing to help him from these various facets of nature. And finally, Amar, Ein Hadavar Talui Elabi. He says, the matter is in my hands alone. Okay? Hiniach Rosho Bein Birkav Vega'a Bibchia Ad Shiatzta Nishmato. And he put his head between his knees and he cried and cried until he died. Yetzta bat kol ve'amra, Rabbi Elazar ben Zerodiah mezuman l'chaye olam haba. Okay? A heavenly voice comes out and says, Rabbi Elazar ben Zerodiah is invited into the world to come. Okay? And from that, Rebbe, skipping a line, Rebbe cried and he said, Yesh kone olamo bekama shanim v'yesh kone olamo b'sha'a achat. There are some people who work for a lifetime in order to make it into the world to come, and there are others who in a moment get in. Ve'amar Rebbe, and he continues and he says, Lo dayan leba'alei tshuva shemekablin otam, ela shekorin otan Rebbe. And it's not enough that he got into Olam Haba in 1 minute, right? We also give him the title of Rabbi. That's like you see with Rebbe, and this is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the compiler of the Mishnah, that there's a real sadness, right, for someone who has, you know, lived the good life, worked all of his life in being a good Jew. There's kind of a jealousy in that he sees here's someone who lives this life of total hedonism, and then ends up coming into the world to come and being called rabbi, and here I am, you know, working so hard for that same result. Yeah.
Do you see this as tears of like jealousy or tears of joy that like how great and gracious is God that any even true repenters are brought like?
Right. You know, it's nice. I mean, I don't see the tears as tears of joy. I see them as tears of, if it's jealousy, a slight bitterness, a feeling of, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you could see them the other way, but I do think that there's a certain edge to it, when he says "Lo dayan labali tshuva shemekabli notam ela shakori notan Rebbe," literally he's saying, "What, it's not enough for people who repent that we let them in? Like, that should be enough for them. We also have to call them rabbi? Like, that's too much." So I do see a certain not nice edge to it, which I think comes from having worked his whole life, having stood on the straight and narrow, and I guess seeing like, wow, for him it was so easy, and for me, I'm spending my whole life, you know, it's not like I'm partying my whole life and then at the last moment getting into Olam Haba. But the point, what I want to focus on in the story is the realization that Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya comes to, okay, when he says, "Ein hadavar talui ela bi," that the matter is in my own hands, and then he dies. What do you think happens in that moment? Like, what do you think his realization is? How does it connect to his death? Come on. There's a lot of different ways of reading the story, and it's a very rich story in terms of all of its details. But I want to suggest a reading, okay? There are some of the Rishonim who say that at that moment he repented. And some of them actually even added into the Talmudic text that he actually repented at that moment and then put his head between his knees and he cried until he died. But the way that I always liked reading this story is to say he realized, right, he tried to go to the various facets of nature and not take that personal responsibility and say, okay, heavens and earth, you pray to God for me. Stars, you pray to God for me. When he realizes, wow, it's in my hands alone, right, you would think it could be the moment for him to start a new life, right, and say, wow, it's in my hands, I'm going to change. But that's not what he says. He cries, he kind of curls up into this fetal position and cries until he dies. And I think that what's going on here is that he realizes the matter is in my hands, but there's nothing I can do about it. Because I think that he realizes that he's in a certain cycle, whether it's his nature or his habit, his lifestyle, whatever it is, that I can have this realization today, but tomorrow my life is not going to be any different. And so he sits there and cries until almost like God has mercy on him and lets him die in the moment of that realization as opposed to in the moment after.
What do you say? That he's saying, I can't change?
Yeah, I think that he is saying, I can't change. And in that stark recognition, I am who I am and I'm not going to change, there's a tshuva in that too. There's a repentance in the realization of, this is who I am, this is how I was made, and what can I do? And I think that it's particularly interesting, and just with the next story, the juxtaposition. Because after the story of Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, who traveled the seven rivers to find this prostitute that he hadn't slept with, we have a story of two other rabbis who are walking along on their way, and there's a fork in the road, and they say, okay, we could either go this way and pass a house of idolatry, and then, you know, but there's no desire for idolatry, so we won't get any reward. Or we could walk a different way where we pass a brothel, and then we'll get rewarded for overcoming our temptations. And they say, okay, let's walk this way. We'll pass the brothel, and we'll overcome our temptations. And they walk, and they pass the brothel, and the prostitutes literally shrink away from them. Okay, and they say, okay, hooray, we're getting a reward. And I think that there's a certain irony in the juxtaposition of these two stories. Because on the one hand, you have Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, who because of his nature would cross the seven seas in order to seek out a prostitute. And on the other hand, you have these two rabbis who because of their natures were able to say, let's walk past the brothel and we'll be okay. because we're not really in danger of succumbing to temptation. And you have those stories next to each other, I think, to show that people are different, okay? And people are struggling with different things. And for some people, sexuality might not be that much of a struggle, or might be something like these rabbis say, you know, we'll walk past the brothel and then we'll get rewarded, right? It might be something that's easy to overcome. And for other people, more in the category of Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, it might be a serious struggle where one isn't able to overcome. So what I like about this Gemara and why I think it's important is because it makes us realize just human diversity. People are different, and people's struggles in the realm of sexuality are very different. And we can't assume that, you know, my struggle is your struggle, right? Everyone is struggling with different things, and against the backdrop of their unique nature, you know, and who they are. And so whether you're like Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, like these other two rabbis, or like something totally different, the different models exist. Okay, and the point is to see that even within the Talmud, the model exists for a person who literally spends his whole life running after prostitutes and yet can still be called rabbi and yet can still make it into Olam Haba. So it's, in other words, it's possible to go through those struggles and it's possible to come out on the other side or not. I feel like I'm throwing a lot at you. But basically, these are some Talmudic stories. There are a couple of more that we won't get to. A story in Kiddushin, really showing that no one is safe from struggling with desire. They're great stories if you want to read them. All of them also, I should have mentioned this at the beginning, are passages and stories from which I think we can draw out a sexual ethic, which we haven't worked on today at all. But I'm giving you the stories to kind of have in your minds as we learn the halachic texts also. In other words, to have that balance of the narrative, of the human side, of the story, of how this gets integrated into life, and then the law and the kind of more cold and concrete law. And I think ultimately it's about making that, you know, navigating between those various sides and what we choose from each. So, to think about. Thanks. Shabbat shalom. Okay. This is for you. This.